You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
I'm your host for today. My name is Aaron Wang, and I'm joined by my co-host, Brandon Brownlee. Today, we're going to continue the mini-series we've been going through on the history of Western philosophy. On last episode, we talked about the medieval period of Western philosophy, and today, we're going to start by delving into some of the Renaissance period, which is a little bit before the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment period is considered early modern by most historians. So I'm going to quote a bit from the article from Western Philosophy, the History of Western Philosophy on Encyclopedia Britannica, if you're wondering what our sources are. The philosophy of a period arises as a response to social need and the development of philosophy in the history of Western civilization since the Renaissance has thus reflected the process in which creative philosophers have responded to the unique challenges of each stage in the development of Western culture itself. The career of philosophy, how it views its tasks and functions, how it defines itself, the special methods it invents for the achievement of philosophical knowledge, the literary forms it adopts and utilizes, its conception of the scope of its subject matter, and its changing criteria of meaning and truth hinges on the mode of its successive responses to the challenges of the social structure within which it arises. Thus, Western philosophy in the Middle Ages was primarily a Christian philosophy, complementing the divine revelation, reflecting the feudal order in its cosmology, devoting itself in no small measure to the institutional tasks of the Roman Catholic Church. It was no accident that the major philosophical achievements of the 13th and 14th centuries were the work of churchmen who also happened to be professors of theology at the universities of Oxford and Paris. The Renaissance of the late 15th and 16th centuries presented a different set of problems and therefore suggested different lines of philosophical endeavor. What is called the European Renaissance followed the introduction of three novel mechanical inventions from the East: gunpowder, block printing for movable type, and the compass. The first was used to explode the massive fortifications of the feudal order, and thus became an agent of the new spirit of nationalism that threatened the rule of churchmen, and indeed the universalist emphasis of the church itself, with a competing secular power. The second, printing, propagated knowledge widely, secularized learning, and reduced the intellectual monopoly of an ecclesiastical elite, and restored the literacy and philosophical classes of Greece and Rome. The third, the compass, increased the safety and scope of navigation, produced the voyages of discovery that opened up the Western Hemisphere, and symbolized a new spirit of physical adventure and a new scientific interest in the structure of the natural world. So I'm going to stop there for a moment. It's definitely, I would say, an interesting take on the time period and the nature of philosophy itself. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious to see what Brandon has to say. I think they are assuming a little bit about the nature of culture and that philosophy is a reaction to culture. I think that's a very interesting perspective. I think it's one that a lot of people would agree with to some regard, especially since philosophy, fundamentally speaking, is more or less always a criticism of culture and a criticism of society, because especially like as we saw with Socrates when we were talking about the classical period, as we saw in the medieval period, where it was actually very interesting that philosophy and logic became essentially a means of propping up one set of people or creating a new culture from the separate European nations to one nation, to many nations under one church, I should say. So that's more or less the development of Western Europe.
There's one interesting omission, I think, in this, because I think the progress of invention narrative is true. Certain technologies were created that allowed for certain ways of going about being in the world. It existed, essentially. Hannah Arendt makes this interesting point about the telescope, though, and this is the interesting omission. We'll get to the telescope when we talk about Galileo, but the interesting thing about the telescope is that for Arendt, the telescope is kind of the symbol of this relationship between technology and science. You, for the first time, you come upon a tool that lets you see farther than your natural instruments allow you to see. And since science is going to begin moving in a highly empirical direction, your capacity to do science is intrinsically tied to your technological capacities. So I think this is the way that this narrative between, and also proviso, at this point, science and philosophy haven't entirely parted ways. Science goes under the name natural philosophy at this point. So I think this is where the understanding of technology and philosophy comes in, because nowadays we understand philosophy as the humanities, but that isn't such a decisive difference yet. So I think the article is actually doing a very good job looking at these technologies and whatnot. Again, there's lots of different ways that civilizations progress or change or go through all kinds of different transformations. So, and this is not the only way of tracking those changes, but it is a kind of tried and true way of doing it. And this is the period where technology is exploding, as the article puts it. I mean, there were technologies before, sure, and they've made significant differences, but here it's just one after the other, it's exponential at this point. And so philosophy kind of tracks onto that because natural science is tracking onto that.
Yeah. I mean, a thought that occurs to me just now is when you think about what an invasive species has an effect on a new environment, usually it grows out of proportion. It's almost like technologies created in other cultures, when they're introduced to new cultures, kind of have a similar explosive effect like an invasive species. Each of these inventions, with its wider cultural consequences, presented new intellectual problems and novel philosophical tasks within a changing political and social environment. As the power of a single religious authority was slowly eroded under the influence of the Protestant Reformation, and as the prestige of the universal Latin language gave way to vernacular tongues, philosophers became less and less identified with their positions in the ecclesiastical hierarchy, and more identified with their national origins. The works of Albertus Magnus, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Bonaventure, John Duns Scotus, had been basically unrelated to the countries of their birth. But the philosophy of Niccolo Machiavelli was directly related to Italian experience, and that of Francis Bacon was English to the core, as was that of Thomas Hobbes. In the early modern period, likewise, the thought of René Descartes set the standard and tone of intellectual life in France for 200 years. Philosophy becomes not just a means of understanding the world, and this is kind of the interesting thing about the history of Western philosophy, is that the West starts with one tradition, because it basically has to, right? Every tradition has to come from some place. During the Renaissance, it starts to branch out quite a bit more, and this is with that natural progression of people starting to write in their own languages versus writing in Latin. And that brings with it philosophies that are and works of writing, works of literature that are intended not for the general audience of everyone who speaks Latin, but for those people of specific languages and specific cultures in specific nations. So yeah, it's a very interesting development. Knowledge in the contemporary world is conventionally divided between the natural sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities. In the Renaissance, however, fields of learning had not yet become so sharply departmentalized. In fact, each of these divisions arose in the comprehensive and broadly inclusive area of philosophy. As the Renaissance mounted its revolt against the reign of religion and therefore reacted against the church, against authority, against scholasticism, and against Aristotle, there was a sudden blossoming of interest in problems centering on civil society, humankind, and nature. These three areas correspond exactly to the three dominant strands of Renaissance philosophy: political philosophy, humanism, and the philosophy of nature. It's interesting to characterize this as a revolt, because I think in some ways it is a revolt. In other ways, you could consider it as a natural progression. And I guess that depends on which side of history you are on, whether or not you see the changes that are happening in Europe as being something that is natural, the development of new cultures and the changing of traditions, or whether you see that as something that is strange and unusual. It's hard to describe because it's not something that we think about too often, but there are nations that have a very strict idea of identity, and there are nations that have a less restrictive idea of identity or a less unified idea of identity. And in Europe, once you've looked at a few of those time lapses of the maps of Europe changing over time, you can see that many countries and areas of land are inhabited by different groups that belong to different princes, which are technically part of different nations. It isn't till the 19th century that Germany is united as a nation, and until then it exists as more or less independent provinces governed by princes. It's important to understand that the map of Europe is not consistent, and so the changes that are happening in philosophy, I guess I'm back on the side of the article here, are reflective of the cultural changes that are happening in Europe. Those changes have broader implications, but I think it's important to note that in previous ages, it probably wasn't as, the changes were not as vast. So it's like if you were governed by the Italians versus if you were governed by the French or governed by the English, that wouldn't necessarily have had as stark differences as they started to have during the Renaissance. People and different nations in Europe started developing new specific ideas of how secular authority and ecclesiastical authority should be related, and those fundamentally changed the destinies of many nations.
This is really the beginning of, you start seeing philosophies associated with different regions. I mean, in the Middle Ages, you had them associated with certain universities, and that's kind of seen a revival now with the, you know, Anglo-analytic versus French continental philosophies and whatnot. Sure, here it really is at a kind of a national level. You start seeing English philosophy as distinct from philosophy on the continent, which basically means Descartes. And that really wasn't going on before. I mean, people were trading ideas quite freely and not having any partiality to them in that way, I guess, because the schools were quite isolated to things like particular religious faiths and whatnot, or truth revealed in that way, or actual just intellectual disputes like Platonism versus Aristotelianism. those disputes are coming up again now that we're dealing with natural philosophy. And I think that's largely what motivates the rejection of Aristotle by these new thinkers. I mean, the scholastics hold on to Aristotle because he's very good at explaining and being synthesized into a Christian tradition. Man, his physics just like doesn't work, you know? So they got to figure out what to do with that. And Galileo figures out what to do with that. Stop reading Aristotle and start doing a new kind of physics.
As the secular authority replaced ecclesiastical authority, and as the dominant interest of the age shifted from religion to politics, it was natural that the rivalries of the national states and their persistent crises of internal order should raise with renewed urgency philosophical problems, practically dormant since pre-Christian times, about the nature and the moral status of political power. This new preoccupation with national unity, internal security, state power, and international justice stimulated the growth and political philosophy in Italy, France, England, and Holland. We're seeing nations that, because of technology, now have a new interest in trade, in advancing these technologies and applying them in new ways. And, of course, that having political implications. So our first thinker that we're talking about is Machiavelli. Machiavelli, sometime state secretary of the Florentine Republic, explored techniques for the seizure and retention of power in ways that seemed to exalt reasons of state above morality. His The Prince and Discourses on the first 10 books of Livy, both published posthumously, codified the actual practices of Renaissance diplomacy for the next 100 years. In fact, Machiavelli was motivated by patriotic hopes for the ultimate unification of Italy, and by the conviction that the moral standards of contemporary Italians needed to be elevated by restoring ancient Roman virtues. More than half a century later, the French philosopher John Bodin insisted that the state must possess a single unified sovereign power. He thus developed in detail the doctrine of national sovereignty as the source of all legal legitimacy. In England, Hobbes, who was to become tutor to the future King Charles II, developed the fiction that in the state of nature that precedes civilization, every man's hand was raised against every other, and human life was accordingly solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. A social contract was thus agreed upon to convey all private rights to a single sovereign, in return for general protection and the institution of a reign of law. Because law is simply the command of the sovereign, Hobbes at once turned justice into a byproduct of power, and denied any right of rebellion except when the sovereign becomes too weak to protect the commonwealth or to hold it together. In Holland, a prosperous and tolerant commercial republic in the 17th century, the issues of political philosophy took a different form. The Dutch East India Company commissioned a great jurist, Hugo Grotius, to write a defense of their trading rights and their free access to the seas, and the resulting two treatises, The Freedom of the Seas, 1609, and On the Law of War and Peace, 1625, were the first significant codifications of international law. Their philosophical originality lay, however, in the fact that in defending the rights of a small, militarily weak nation against the powerful states of England, France, and Spain, Grotius was led to a preliminary investigation of the sources and validity of the concept of natural law. The notion that inherent in human reason and immutable even against the willfulness of sovereign states are imperative considerations of natural justice and moral responsibility, which must serve as a check against the arbitrary exercise of vast political power. In general, the political philosophy of the Renaissance and the early modern period was dualistic. It was haunted, even confused, by the conflict between political necessity and general moral responsibility. Machiavelli, Bodin, and Hobbes asserted claims that justified the actions of Italian despotism and the absolutism of the Bourbon and Stuart dynasties. Yet Machiavelli was obsessed with the problem of human virtue. Bodin insisted that even the sovereign ought to obey the law of nature, that is to govern in accordance with the dictates of natural justice. And Hobbes himself found in natural law the rational motivation that causes a person to seek security and peace. In the end, Renaissance and early modern political philosophy advocated the doctrines of Thrasymachus, who held that right is what is in the interest of the strong, but it could never finally escape a twinge of Socratic conscience.
What is central to thinking about polis is power. Even independent of legitimation, it's almost a kind of craft that one is beginning to work. I mean, if you read The Prince, most of it is how to do stuff with power. You know, there's lots of justifications for it, but it's also, okay, you've got the justification, now here's what to do with it. Justifying the power of the sovereign or the leaders of the political community obviously has been a preoccupation of political philosophy, extending all the way back to the Republic. You know, why does the philosopher get to rule? You know, well, the philosopher gets to rule because they are the wisdom in the city, just like wisdom should rule in the soul. There's a legitimation for having philosophers rule, but that's not really in reference to their power. Here, it's that sovereigns should rule because they have the power to rule, or in the case of Hobbes, no one lives a good life. Everyone seeks felicity. No one can live a good life unless the sovereign has power and can maintain a state of civility, keep away a state of nature. I don't know. I'm just noticing this preoccupation with power, and that it kind of enters in here is quite, and it enters in a naturalistic way, right? I mean, that's Hobbes's whole point. He wants to see humans in a kind of mechanistic way. He says the heart is a spring. You know, the body is composed of springs and wheels. And here's one good way of thinking about the kind of the unit of politics is power. So it reduces it down to something calculable and intelligible.
I do think it's definitely something that is arising, as the article first stated, in response to the developments in culture. There's sort of a moral vacuum that's being created now that the Roman Catholic Church is no longer the sole authority of moral responsibility. Now the question is, well, if rulers are not to look to the Roman Catholic Church for, you know, the justifications and to seek out guidance for moral responsibility, then they have to figure it out on their own. They have to have some natural justification independent of different types of Christian thought to judge their decisions by. So it's, I think it's very interesting, especially that Holland creates these treaties saying that, you know, hey, look, we're a small nation. We know that we're militarily inferior. Naturally speaking, that would mean that, you know, you should just be able to conquer us, but we don't think that should be the case. We think that we all would benefit more if we were all given free access to the sea. And accordingly, we were also given access to some amount of reasonable international law. And I think it's very interesting to me just to think about, like, that's how it came about, because I'm not someone who believes in historic inevitability. I don't think that it had to be the case that international law or a basis of international law was founded in Holland. Maybe it could have come out of England. Maybe it could have come out of France. I think that there definitely were probably some geographic reasons why it did come out of Holland.
I was interested to find that those treatises were commissioned by the Dutch East India Company. I found that's one of, I've always had this question, you know, could you commission a philosophical work? What would that look like?
Apparently in Europe at this time. It's also interesting that the company is commissioning this. And this also talks a little bit about the origins of corporate law, of starting a company. It's becoming so normal now to get on a boat and do something. and to go and collect funding for this. I mean, it was actually, I believe it is in this exact period. This is the period of time where Elizabeth I has to fend off a Spanish invasion. How she does it somewhat brilliantly is by causing attacks of piracy on Spanish vessels, which are funded by Italian bankers. Eventually, it becomes not the problem for the Italian bankers that their ships are being sunk, and so therefore they have to keep paying out insurance on all of these vessels. But the risk of the British attacking these vessels into the future drives up the cost of the Spanish in terms of insurance premiums. And so it's very interesting to think about the financial situations of Europe. And I don't know if anyone has done a good piece of philosophical work talking about kind of the origins of finance and trade and all of those effects in Europe. I do know of a few works that touch on it a little bit. I know that there is a very good work on salt and its effect on trade.
I think the article is right to say that the invention of new technologies influences philosophy. Why couldn't the change in the way that we trade salt influence the way we do philosophy? I'm sure it has it's of some kind of philosophical import.
I want to remind your listeners that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and today's episode is on the period of the Renaissance, going through our mini-series on the history of Western philosophy.
Of the Renaissance, one of the things I think about mostly is humanism and the rediscovery of the Roman and Greek classics. Just getting access to text was really important. Those were philosophical developments. And here we have, just like an explosion of technology, we have an explosion of ancient corpuses to draw from. That's originally what humanism means. Of course, it has a turn from the theological to the humane, but it actually means a turn to humane letters as opposed to the jargon-laden scholasticism. It is a reaction against certain kinds of language, but that is a bit... I mean, it's an important point, so I will say it. But in any case... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, please reiterate the point on scholasticism, because I think that's very important for readers to understand why that was a necessary development. Or
yes.
What might have happened had that not occurred.
Yeah, so, I mean, scholasticism was a method of doing philosophy in the medieval period. It emerges out of Lombardo's logical treatises, where he is basically putting things in, not in a Platonic dialogue, but in a antithetical sense, testing theses against each other. I think he models it on Aristotle's eudoxic method of testing things within, you know, getting the good opinions and testing things against one another. But in any case, what emerges is this scholastic exercise in the universities, where you have one person make an argument and then another person will make a contrary argument. And then it's up to the professor to kind of mediate between them. Again, you can see how this is Aristotelian. And these get called various names by later thinkers in the Renaissance and the early modern period. Francis Bacon will call this a very disputatious method. It's not very conducive of discovering what people want to discover now in the Renaissance, like natural experimentation and whatnot. It's more or less just seeing, okay, well, it's like, not to say that debate club is bad, but it's self-contained debate more or less between the propositions that you elect to put into the scholastic disputation. So it loans itself to feeling kind of dry. It doesn't really get anywhere. The Renaissance thinkers want to get somewhere. There's all this new stuff to do. So why would we just throw around Aristotle when we've got Plato to read, or we've got places to go, or we've got, you know, laws to enact and whatnot? We have to do stuff, not just do these boring logical exercises. That's in the Middle Ages. This is the Renaissance. In any case, I will continue reading the article. The Renaissance was characterized by the revival of interest in mathematics, medicine, and classical literature. The study of mathematics and medicine sparked the scientific revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries, while the study of classical literature became the foundation of the philosophy of Renaissance humanism. Generally suspicious of science and indifferent to religion,